The following is a rebroadcast of a previous program.
This is Mayo Clinic Radio, the only show that gives you the chance to ask your questions to Mayo Clinic experts. We'll take you beyond the headlines to explain what developments in medicine mean to you. Join the conversation by phone, Twitter, Facebook, or radio.mayoclinic.org. Now, with this week's program, here are your hosts, Dr. Tom Shives and Tracy McRae.
From the Mayo Clinic, Rochester, Minnesota campus, I'm Tracy McRae.
And I'm Dr. Sanj Kakkar.
Dr. Shives is on an assignment, and as usual, probably on a golf course somewhere. You suppose, Dr. Kakkar?
I'm hoping so.
Welcome, everyone, to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Oncolytic viral therapy. I don't even know if I'm saying it right. It's a great big term that is for something truly amazing. Doctors are essentially using re-engineered viruses to infect and kill cancer cells, all the while sparing normal tissue. Our guests today are Dr. Stephen Russell and his patient, Stacy Erholtz. Stacy took part in a groundbreaking study at Mayo Clinic to treat her multiple myeloma, which is a cancer of the blood and bone marrow. Dr. Russell gave Stacy 100 billion doses, or 10 million doses. We'll figure that out in just a moment, too. It's a seemingly lethal amount of the measles virus, which led to a miraculous improvement in Stacy's health.
We'll listen to Stacy's amazing story. It really is a true treat to hear and discuss the science behind virus therapy and learn about where future research may be heading. For example, are there other diseases which can be cured by using such viruses? And where did all those viruses indeed come from? But first, it seems that every one of these has these days a healthy tracker bracelet, a wearable wireless tracking device for measuring healthy activity. There are lots of them to choose from, for example, a Fitbit, a Jawbone, or a Fuel Band, to name a few. Even my father has one. But you have to wonder, do they work, or an expensive bracelet, or a lot of hype? Mayo Clinic anesthesiologist Dr. David Cook set out about to find out and joins us now. Greetings, Dr. Cook.
Good morning, Son.
Good morning. Tell us about this study and these health tracker bracelets.
What we're interested in doing is understanding mobility in patients. And mobility is important because it's really gaining functional independence after a health intervention is what patients really want. Mobility is sort of hard for us to document as care providers, and very simple consumer technology make things possible that were never possible before.
Yeah, well, if people aren't aware of what a Fitbit is or a Jawbone is, can you explain to our listeners what they do?
These are simple pieces of consumer technology that are typically designed to support individuals in their quests for physical activity and fitness. And they're small devices. They can be a wristband like a watch band. They can be a clip, maybe half the size of a clothespin, if we even know what clothespins are anymore. Or they could be a small device worn that may be between the size of a quarter and a half dollar.
There was
these have tiny little gyroscopes in them.
Yeah, there was a study that the Wall Street Journal talked about, and that's where you come in. And you studied heart patients, or who did you study exactly?
Well, we're doing a whole bunch of stuff. We began with heart patients, and that's what caught the attention of the Wall Street Journal. What we did in about 150 patients was put these consumer devices on patients after heart surgery and literally just determine how their mobility recovered after having a major operation. The devices have a Bluetooth capacity. They transmit wirelessly to a computer, and we're able to see how much time patients are out of bed and how much they're walking. And what we showed was that mobility after a major operation is predictive of how well patients are going to do and whether they're going to go home independently or not.
Yeah, it's an interesting tool that you're using it for that way to help someone recover from a surgery. I think a lot of, you know, you buy these things for $100. Sanj, you got one for your father?
Yeah, the highlight of his day is when it says goal at the end of the day and he's met the number of steps he needs to walk.
Yeah, I got one for my husband. He just loves figuring out where he's at on his day of how it works. Like you can plug it in and figure out your chart of how you're doing. Do you think that this is helping people to become more active?
I think it's probably helping some people to become more active. Its application in healthcare is just evolving. Certainly, if you're interested in your own fitness and having data and getting feedback is going to support your reaching your goals. But where it becomes interesting is when healthcare providers can see how well patients are doing. So what we're doing right now with these devices is in patients that have just had hip surgery, who are older patients, and in patients that have been hospitalized with a major medical diagnosis, we're giving them all this technology and they're wearing it for 30 days after hospitalization, and we can see how well they're recovering. This gives us an opportunity then in the future to understand what's normal and what's not and intervene when patients are not meeting essentially functional expectations.
No, I think you've hit the nail on the head there, Dr. Cook, in that in physicians, we see patients in our office anywhere from 10 minutes to an hour, but we really don't know what they do when they leave us. And so by having that data, for example, you just said with hip surgery patients, it really tells us how they're mobilizing, if they're doing it, and how we can help them.
And it may speak to problems with hospital readmission, theoretically pneumonia, deep venous thrombosis, and falls.
Yes.
And there's huge blind spots in medicine, which I think really what you were saying, Sanjan, this sort of continuous stream of data allows us to fill in a lot of the blank spots.
I even think the thing that's interesting is even just the sleep information that you can get from some of them, you know, how well you slept and how often you were awake and how deeply you slept. And it's a lot of interesting information. Do you think, you know, when you read the piece in the Wall Street Journal, or I've read other things where folks are worried that that information might end up being used against patients because if their doctors can see that, can you comment on that whole line of thought?
Well, certainly the confidentiality of information is absolutely critical. And one could imagine, just like insurers charge you more if you have a lot of accidents, theoretically, your costs of care might be influenced by things like your weight or your mobility.
Sure. I like the idea that if they can see from a tracker how active you are, maybe your premiums could go down.
Maybe your premiums could go down. And if we can create care models that support that, then when patients are in compliance with expectations for physical activity, they're going to have probably less complications and their costs and the cost of healthcare are going to decrease.
Yeah.
This is just brand new stuff that's going to probably change the way healthcare is delivered.
Well, maybe on the flip side, if you're not active, it'll give you a little shock to get up.
or right now, to be completely frank, we're calling patients.
Right.
You know, we know right now in patients that they're normally out of bed at 9 o'clock and walk 1,000 steps by noon. And I can have somebody call a patient's home if they're not up and say, did you forget to wear your device or is everything okay?
Wow.
So are the patients buying the devices themselves, or how does that work?
Right now, we're providing what amounts to a technology package, and there's all kinds of learnings that are going on. So all of our patients are older, and we found about 40% of them didn't have either a computer or wireless at home that would allow us to get the data. So we're sending them home with a Fitbit. We're sending them home with a mobile phone. On which the software is configured, and that phone sends us data continuously.
Wow, it's exciting. I'm glad that you spent some time with us today, Dr. Cook. You can find more in that Wall Street Journal article that is at radio.mayoclinic.org. Thanks so much, Dr. Cook. Have a great
day.
Thank
you, Tracy.
All right.
Thank you, Sanj.
Thank you.
It's time for a short break. Coming up, we'll talk with Mayo Clinic hematologist Dr. Stephen Russell from Mayo Clinic and his patient, Stacy Erholtz, about viral therapy and how it was used to help Stacy.
You can listen to Mayo Clinic Radio at any time on iHeartRadio, or you can contact us by going to our Mayo Clinic Radio website, radio.mayoclinic.org. You can also tweet us anytime at #MayoClinicRadio. We're back right after this.
You are listening to a previously recorded program.
Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Radio. I'm Tracy McRae along with Dr. Sanj Kakkar, and our guest, Dr. Stephen Russell, is here, hematologist for Mayo Clinic. Good morning, Dr. Russell.
Good morning, Tracy.
Very nice to meet you. And the real star of the show, I think, is Stacey Erholtz. I know that for a fact. Good morning, Stacey.
Good morning.
Stacey is Dr. Russell's patient. So before we, I don't even know where to start with this. I'm so excited to talk about this new horizon of medicine. Dr. Russell, tell us a little bit about viral therapy.
Okay, well, the concept is that we all know that viruses destroy tissue. All of us have had a virus, and there are different viruses. Pneumonia, influenza virus attacks the lungs. The hepatitis viruses attack the liver, and other viruses attack other tissues. So the idea here is that a virus can be engineered or adapted to specifically attack cancer cells and to destroy them. And this has a very long history, this field of work. Ever since viruses were first isolated back in the 1950s, people have been giving viruses to cancer patients. And really, the results have not been that encouraging. So it's been a massive field of research for a long time. You know, everybody's believed that this really can actually work, mm-hmm. but nobody's really seen it working in people.
So the hepatitis, you know, destroys the liver. So you're creating a virus that destroys cancer? Is that what you're doing? Destroys the tumor? How does that work?
There are two ways of changing a virus so that it will attack a cancer specifically. One is that you can allow it to evolve and adapt in the lab by growing it on cancer cells. And that's what actually happened with this particular strain of measles virus. It's a sub-strain of the measles vaccine. Originally came from the throat of a patient, David Edmonston, in 1954. It was then grown on many different cell types in the lab to create all of the vaccines that have been used to control measles in the Western world.
That all comes from one patient?
From one patient,
wow.
David Edmonston. And then we took a sub-strain of that Edmonston lineage of viruses that had been taught how to grow on human cancer cells. And we engineered it to make it a more suitable agent to use for cancer treatment. And that's what we've taken all the way through to clinical testing.
Hmm.
And that was the virus that eventually Stacey received. And she received the virus at the very top dose level.
At this point, is it going to go higher, or is it gone as high as it can go?
It's going to be hard to go higher. Mm-hmm. We could theoretically take it higher if we could solve the manufacturing problem. Because as you mentioned earlier, this is a massive, massive dose and challenges us.
Let's get over to Stacey's story. And Stacey, first of all, thank you for being here. Can you explain to us what multiple myeloma is and when you were diagnosed?
Well, I was diagnosed in May of 2004. And as I understand it, multiple myeloma is cancer of my blood plasma in my bone marrow. But I've choose not to over-educate. I just follow directions, and I trust.
You explained before we got going that you looked online once and then didn't do it ever again.
Well, occasionally I peek just to see if there's any new treatments coming down the line, but I don't look at any kind of prognosis or this, that, or the other. It's a downer. There's no sense in living that way.
And multiple myeloma is one of those tough cancers to have. Is that right, Dr. Russell?
Yeah, it is a tough cancer. It's, there are worse cancers to have. And, you know, we do have quite a few good drug treatments. But typically, eventually, they stop working. And that's basically what happened with Stacey.
And do most multiple myeloma patients have it in, like she said, in her blood? Or is it in your, where does it go in the body?
It lives in the bone marrow, and it's a bit like leukemias live in the bone marrow. So it's very similar to leukemia with one difference, which is that in addition to just being spread throughout the bone marrow, it forms these solid tumors that can be destructive to the bone. And actually, Stacey had both of those. She had the cells throughout the bone marrow, and she had five tumors that we could see on her PET CT scan.
Well, we're very lucky, Tracy. I mean, Stacey's sitting in front of us. Yeah. She looks absolutely amazing. When she walked into the building, I was just stunned in how good she looks. Dr. Russell, do you feel that, you mentioned chemotherapy, do you feel that viral technology is the way of the future in terms of replacing chemotherapy or having a synergistic effect?
Well, I would. I've spent my life working on viruses as a therapy, so the idea that it will replace chemotherapy is extremely appealing. And certainly, in mouse models, you know, we can cure mice of their cancer with a single intravenous dose of a virus. So, we would love to be able to translate that completely into the clinical cancer arena. And Stacey really has given us a glimpse of that potentially being possible, but combination with existing drugs may be the pragmatic way to go, and it may make the virus more potent.
And how do you make this such that the virus attacks the cancer cells but doesn't attack normal tissue?
Well, serendipity had a lot to do with it in this mm-hmm. case, in that the measles virus that we've been using just learned how to specifically attack cancer cells, and in doing so lost the ability to attack normal tissues. And that's how it's been effective and safe as a vaccine for so long.
Hold on, it just learned how to do it, or is it genetically engineered to do it, or how does that happen?
Viruses learn. Viruses change over time, and they adapt to the tissue that they're given to grow on. But the other approach, and one that we're very interested in and doing a lot of work on at Mayo, is to specifically engineer the virus so that it can only attack the cancer cells. And we can do that in a number of different ways. You know, there are many targeting strategies to teach the virus specifically attack the cancer and do not attack anything else.
As I was preparing for this and reading all sorts of things about you, we had talked for just a few moments when this story first came out earlier this year. A very unusual circumstance came up where I came across you gave Stacey 10 million doses or 100 billion doses. That's quite a big, that can't just be an editing mistake at the newspaper or wherever I was reading. So explain that difference to me.
Okay, so we're not using this as a vaccine. You know, people often kind of misunderstand what we've done. We're using this as a weapon, and we're giving a massive dose of the virus. And it's, instead of provoking an immune response that'll protect you against measles, we're asking the virus to go in, infect the cancer cells everywhere, and directly kill them. So we're using it in a very different way, so the dose has to be super high. With a vaccine, you want to give the lowest dose you possibly can to teach the immune system to protect you. With measles, that dose is 1,000 infectious particles.
Okay.
And so typically they package the vaccine into vials that have 10,000, just in case some of them die. And so you can be sure everybody will get enough. So we've given to Stacey 100 billion. That's 10 to the 11th. And that would be 10 million times the dose that's packaged in the vial. And it's 100 million times the dose you have to give to vaccinate.
So all the answers are correct.
Yep.
So to speak.
Yep. It's,
All right, Stacey, you were diagnosed in 2004. And what treatments did you have before you got to becoming this test subject?
Oh, I've had multiple treatments. It's been a series of really just patchworking time together. I started with thalidomide and dexamethasone, went into a stem cell transplant, had some remission without any drugs, but basically was on a maintenance therapy for most of these last 10 years. So taking an oral chemotherapy and steroid dose every day, on a regular basis.
And you, Dr. Russell mentioned that you had 5 tumors throughout your body. And can you explain to people who weren't listening the first time that he was on in May, who is Evan?
Oh, Evan is one of my tumors, my plasmacytomas. Right on my forehead, so you really couldn't miss him. He was the size of a golf ball. So my children named him Evan because we would talk about him quite often, and plasmacytoma was just too much to... Blah, blah, blah. So anyhow, Evan, yes. And Evan would come on the scene. I typically knew my cancer was coming back or I was falling out of remission because Evan would present before anything would present in the testing. And so,
and the other tumors that you had were just throughout your body. Were they showing up like a golf ball, or were they inside?
They were inside. I didn't know they were there.
So Evan was your barometer.
Exactly.
And so Evan was your barometer when it was disappearing as well.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, 36 hours after having received the measles dose, Evan was gone. So I knew that it was working.
So Stacey, how did you feel when Dr. Russell turned around and said, we're going to give you a virus? I mean, most patients would be fraught with somebody suggesting that to them. How did you feel? How did you take that?
Actually, I've been telling Dr. Russell that I saw it on the news about 5 years ago. And so since that point, I've been bothering or pestering him about when it was going to be my turn to do the measles clinical study.
Mm-hmm.
And was actually rejected a couple of years ago, which would have been at too low of a dose.
Sure.
So it was remarkable that when it was time, it was at the highest level and they had one available the next Wednesday.
Dr. Russell, do patients usually, in Stacy's shoes, do they pester you? Are there a lot of people? I know since her story has come out, there's a lot of people that want to be in her shoes.
Yeah, so there are many people who do want to be in her shoes now, but previously, no. Stacy had it in her head that she wanted to get this therapy, and she was the only patient who kept coming back asking for it.
And we're just running up against a break here that we're going to have to stop your story. But to continue on, you had the dose when? Last year?
June 5th of last year. So I've had my 1 year anniversary of having had the measles dose.
And it took 36 hours after the dose. What happened?
Well, initially, I felt that something was happening the mm-hmm. minute that I was being infused. And I thought, oh, this is just psychosomatic. But then I had an insane headache. It felt as if my head was going to blow off.
Mm-hmm.
And not only that, but I had a kind of a crazy cough. Mm-hmm. So they gave me some Benadryl and we settled that down.
We'll hear more about that story. You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio. Our guest hematologist, Dr. Stephen Russell and Stacey Erholtz. Coming up this week's health and medical news from Vivian Williams. And right after that, we'll take any phone call questions you have for them at 507-282-1234. And your tweets, hashtag Mayo Clinic Radio. This is Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network.
Hi, I'm Vivian Williams with headlines from the Mayo Clinic News Network. Here's info about how a commonly prescribed muscle relaxant may help fight a rare but bad form of diabetes. The drug called dantrolene prevents the destruction of insulin-producing beta cells in what's called Wolfram syndrome. People with this disease often get type 1 diabetes as kids and need insulin injections several times a day. They might also have hearing loss and vision and balance problems. Well, this drug blocks an enzyme critical to the disease. If the drug works in people with Wolfram syndrome, researchers have a hunch it may also help with other types of diabetes. The research was done by experts at Washington University Medical Center in St. Louis. And now, before reaching for that daily antacid, you might consider what it's doing to the trillions of bugs living in your gut. A new Mayo Clinic study in the journal Microbiome shows that people who regularly take proton pump inhibitors, or PPIs, have less diversity in their gut bacteria. That puts them at increased risk for infections like Clostridium difficile and pneumonia, in addition to vitamin deficiencies and bone fractures. Here's Dr. Nicholas Chia.
In this study, we put people on a month-long trial on a proton pump inhibitor and then assess their microbial diversity. And what we found, although this study was very small, we found that the diversity inside of your microbiome decreased. Now that's very interesting because this is the first time anyone has seen a mechanistic reason why C. difficile infection might be linked to proton pump inhibition. And that is because the ecology inside your gut is becoming less diverse and more prone to infection and invasion, and essentially is becoming a weaker ecosystem.
PPIs are a billion-dollar business. People take them to treat ulcers and acid reflux. Dr. Chia says larger studies are needed. And in other news, obstructive sleep apnea, or OSA, is no fun for those who have it or for their bed partners. A telltale sign is when you repeatedly start and stop breathing when you sleep. It causes all sorts of issues, including this newly found one. People with moderate to severe obstructive sleep apnea may not be able to burn high amounts of oxygen during aerobic exercise. Now, this is according to a study from the University of California, San Diego School of Medicine. And even if the person is not obese, which many with OSA are, they have a reduced aerobic fitness level that contributes to the difficulty exercising. They say learning about oxygen levels and volumes of these patients could help identify those at risk of heart attack and stroke, and these measurements could hopefully motivate early interventions to treat OSA. And that's a look at headlines from the Mayo Clinic News Network. I'm Vivian Williams.
You're listening to a previously recorded program.
Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Radio. Information you want from specialists who know, on air, online, and on iHeartRadio.
Time for you to join our conversation. Tweet us at hashtag Mayo Clinic Radio.
Our guest is hematologist Dr. Stephen Russell of the Mayo Clinic, and his patient, multiple myeloma patient, you're kind of a doctor through all you've gone through, probably. Stacey Erholtz is
my
here.
My children think I am.
Yeah. So, Stacey, as the break came in, you were telling us about when you were getting your measles dose. What did we say we need to call it? An infusion, because it wasn't really a dose. It was an infusion of measles therapy, a measles mm-hmm. blast.
Yes.
And as it was happening, you said you had a headache, and then what mm-hmm. happened?
Had a headache. We stopped temporarily. I received Benadryl mainly for this cough I was having, and it seemed to ease the headache as well. And we started the infusion back up, and the minute it was turned off, I was fine.
How long did the whole process take?
40 minutes.
And when that headache was happening, Dr. Russell, were you all just standing there watching Stacey as this happened to her? I mean, because it really is something that you don't know what's going to happen when you give this medicine.
Now, I'm very ashamed to admit it, but I was not actually present at the time that Stacey received her virus. But the headache was very severe. And Stacey was offered the opportunity to discontinue the therapy, but she decided to continue, which I think is incredibly brave, because we simply didn't know what this headache meant or whether something bad was going to happen. And she, after she'd finished the therapy, she was good for 2 hours, and then she started having Rigors, and her temperature, she was shaking, and her temperature
what
went up.
What was that? Rigors?
Rigors.
What does that mean?
Uncontrollable shaking when your temperature's going up. And she was also vomiting. Her temperature went up to 105. She had to have cooling blankets. And that temperature recurred a few times over the next few days. So this was not a completely innocuous therapy.
I can just imagine them watching you as that therapy is going in. And then how long did you just put her in the hospital and we just sit and watch and see what happens? How long did that whole process take?
Well, the next morning I got up and walked across the street to my hotel.
Okay.
So it sounds horrific, and it probably was in the moment horrific, but it is by far the easiest treatment I've ever done. And the
best
remission.
But you felt
so
different right away, you said.
I did. I felt different immediately while I was being infused, and then over the course of 36 hours I could tell it was working because my tumor was disappearing. But by the 4th of July, 1 month later, I had an energy level that I don't remember having ever.
Powered by measles.
Yeah.
That's because Evan had left the building.
Evan had left the building, indeed.
How long did it take for Evan, as we were talking about the tumor, the name that you had given the golf ball-sized tumor on your forehead, how long did it take for him to disappear?
36 hours after having received the infusion.
That's pretty impressive.
So he's my built-in barometer, or was, and... And there he was. I knew it was working.
And Stacy's not the only patient that has had this therapy. Is that correct?
That's correct. At the dose level that we're talking about, the top dose level, there have been 6 patients who've received the therapy.
And what makes her different than the other 5?
Well, 2 of the patients actually have had a response. And both of those patients differ from all the rest in that they do not have any antibody against measles virus. You know, most of us have anti-measles antibodies because we've all been vaccinated as children or we've had measles. But in multiple myeloma, it's first as a consequence of the disease, and second as a consequence of the treatment, a lot of patients lose their anti-measles antibody. And that's what happened to Stacy. So there's no antibody there to block the virus from reaching its target. And the second patient who had no antibody had an awful lot of myeloma in her body. Mm-hmm. She had many tumors that she could feel in her legs and her abdomen. And a week after she received the therapy, we were very excited because she said they're shrinking. She said they were hurting for the first time in a long time after a therapy that she'd been given. Her blood test showed that her cancer was regressing, but almost as fast as it regressed, it regrew. The imaging study that we did at that 1 week time point was just amazing because we have engineered this virus so that we can do a test to see where the virus is in the body.
It glows in the dark?
It glows in the dark. We put a snitch in it so we can do this imaging test. And the amazing thing was that at baseline, before she got the therapy, none of her tumors lit up. And at this 1 week time point, they all lit up.
Wow.
And it was really, truly remarkable. And then that signal faded over the next 2 weeks. And so we felt in her case that we hadn't given enough virus. And had we just been able to go a bit higher, maybe we would have seen a remarkable outcome similar to with Stacy.
So, Dr. Russell, we're going to have many patients at home listening to the story or knowing loved ones who have this condition. Are they all potential patients for this treatment?
No. We are in the process of conducting clinical trials. What we have to do now is we have to move on to what we call a phase 2 clinical trial in which we will treat more patients like Stacy at a similar dose level. Those patients will have to be negative for anti-measles antibody, no antibody in the bloodstream. Mm. And they also are going to have very advanced myeloma that has stopped responding to other therapies. And we'll do this trial under very controlled conditions, and we'll find out from doing this trial how often this treatment can be a benefit to patients.
One of the things that I had not even considered until you mentioned it when we had you on previously was the availability or the production of the vaccine. And then I love it that this is one of the things that Stacy is dedicating her efforts to. So let's talk about the production of that vaccine.
Well, the manufacture of the vaccine was done at Mayo Clinic. We have our own manufacturing facility, and we have an extraordinary team of people who have just continuously pulled rabbits out of hats and got us up to this very high dose level. We're manufacturing to about a thousandfold higher amounts of this measles vaccine virus than the company Merck can do.
Yeah,
Merck is the main producer of the measles vaccine.
That's what I thought.
Yeah, they're pretty impressed with what we've done. And so, but that manufacture is super expensive now. I mean, at this level, a single run, manufacturing run, in a 75-liter culture of cells on which we grow the virus gives us enough for 5 patients at this dose level.
And how long does it take you to make that dosage?
It takes probably 4 to 5 months. By the time all the specialist reagents have been brought in and all the testing has been done on the product to make sure it's safe for human use.
So, Stacy, this is where you come in, because you now are dedicating your efforts to helping in this situation. Tell us about that.
Right. It's very frustrating for me. I want people to receive this dose. I want people that can experience the same type of remission. And I know it's early and I know there's frustration, but the bottleneck really is in the manufacturing piece. And I've started a foundation entitled Let's Go Viral, and it's through the Brainerd Lakes Area Community Foundation, brainerdgiving.org.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm hoping to raise money to get this production moving faster.
And because this radio show is going to be heard all around the country and, of course, all around the world on iHeartRadio,
right.
You need to spell Brainerd for those of us who aren't from Minnesota.
Oh, Brain Nerd. B-R-A-I-N-E-R-D. Brainerd.
So, it's again, that website is?
BrainerdGiving.org. www.heart.org.
we'll look that up for
we'll
you.
We'll look it up.
And we'll tweet it out and put it on our webpage,
Thank
too.
Thank you. Thanks.
But, and so what are you doing? You're raising money through the foundation. Mm-hmm. And then is it coming to Mayo for research, or what are you doing with it?
Well, my desire is that it go directly to manufacturing. So, and I believe after speaking with Mayo reps that I can donate a gift and have it earmarked for a specific reason or purpose. Yes.
You make a compelling salesperson for that pitch, I bet, when you go and talk to people.
Well, they love the story. Everyone loves the story, and it's just been a remarkable, really human interest. There's so many elements that just make it an attractive piece.
And what a catchy slogan, let's go viral.
Let's go viral.
Well, hopefully this show will go viral and will help generate more interest. Dr. Russell, one thing that struck out to me when you were talking earlier in the show was that you were saying that in the lab, you can cure a mouse of this disease. And how does that relate to humans?
There is Stacey a big so mouse? Many, is there, that what's happening? She's
no,
a big
no,
mouse?
No, it's a little mouse. It weighs 25 grams. And there are so many differences between laboratory cancer models and the reality in clinical testing. And, you know, for a long time with this trial at the lower dose levels, we were seeing nothing at all. And it was only when we got up to this very high dose level that we could start to replicate what we're seeing in the mouse models. And so finally, we think we have the connection. So we think now we're at a level in these human studies that we're doing of dosing where the two worlds are connected. Mm. And we can really use the information that we obtain from our mouse studies to inform how best to use this virus in the clinic. Because, in addition to this development we've been talking about and making more of the virus and treating more patients, there's the research side. Mm-hmm. And we really need to work out how best to use the virus. I mean, you alluded to using the virus in combination with drugs so that we can give a lower dose and get the same outcome. And I think that's going to be very important. Also, can we give drugs that will open up the blood vessels in the cancer so that the virus gets there from the bloodstream more efficiently? And so there are many things that we're now looking at that previously we couldn't really connect to what was going on clinically, but now we can.
And are there other areas of application in medicine, for example, using the viruses to deliver stem cells for tissue regeneration?
There are enormous number of applications bubbling up now for viruses in medicine, because viruses, I mean, this whole other topic of gene therapy is really fueled by viruses, because viruses naturally carry their genetic material into cells in the body, so they can be engineered to carry, you know, helpful rather than harmful genes into target sites everywhere, including stem cells. So this is really a very exciting area of medicine. And obviously for the oncolytic viruses, the ones that destroy cancer, measles is not the only one. There are 3,500 viruses in nature.
Are there any that are being studied, or is measles just the top contender, the best runner?
There are many being studied. Measles has really hit the headlines because of Stacey. Because, you know, this is the first time ever anywhere in the world of oncolytic virotherapy a patient with disseminated cancer has had a complete response after intravenous virus administration. It's really energizing for the whole field. It's wonderful.
We do have someone with a question for you. Helen is on the line. Good morning, Helen. Welcome to the program.
Good morning. My brother has myelofibrosis, and he's preparing to have a bone marrow transplant because he doesn't have any more options. And I was wondering if viruses can be used to treat myelofibrosis. He sees Dr. Teferi.
Yes. So he's seeing a wonderful doctor who has got his hands on every possible experimental therapy for myelofibrosis. At the moment, there is no virotherapy study anywhere going on for myelofibrosis. I think that may change in the not-too-distant future, but currently there's nothing available on the virotherapy front.
Thanks for calling in, Helen. That's why this is so exciting right now, because it's just we're at that moment in time where it is all coming together, and Stacy is the patient who was here at this time to say yes and to survive the test run. I mean, just getting right down to it, correct?
That's correct. And, you know, Stacy is, I mean, she's wonderful in so many respects, but the thing that always impresses me so much about Stacy is that there's this huge amount of uncertainty here, as you can imagine. You know, if we go back to Sanjay's question, he was asking me, well, you know, how can you make this a cure? Which, you know, the hidden sort of reality in that question is that for Stacy, this, you know, we cannot call this a cure.
Yes.
But Stacy, I don't know how she does it. She maintains this very sunny, happy persona. She enjoys every day.
How do you do it, Stacy?
Well, I just stay in the moment. And I also have, strong faith.
Mm-hmm.
And I have excellent caregivers, and I have excellent family support, and I trust my doctors and researchers, and truly living in the moment. I can't be overwhelmed by what might come next.
And you had that mindset, I would assume, before you even, before 5 years ago when you ever first heard of this. You've had that mindset since you were diagnosed?
Right. It was always, okay, what are we going to do next? And what is there treatment, a further treatment? I have treatments in my pocket. It doesn't matter if I relapse because I know there's options.
Well, I think Stacy really pays testimony to what this is all about. We treat patients every day at work, and we do research as well for this example, to take our research to actually treat patients. And I think Dr. Russell's work should be commended, with all his collaborators who have helped him to get to this stage where we can have a patient sitting with us who looks full of life.
And what is on the horizon for viral therapy?
Well, before I answer that, I'm just going to pick up on something Sanj just said, because the thing we haven't discussed is the teamwork aspect of this. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I can't begin to describe how wonderful it's been to be doing this work here at Mayo Clinic, because the number of people involved is enormous. There's the team doing manufacturing, the team doing the toxicology testing, the team doing the lab work, the team doing the clinical trial outcomes testing, the team looking after the myeloma patients, the team doing the imaging studies, and all these teams work so selflessly and efficiently together. It's really just an extraordinary place to put all this together. So it's wonderful. What next? Phase 2 clinical trial.
And that starts in September.
That starts in September. We have virus in the freezer. We're ready to go, and we're screening patients for that trial at the moment.
I'm excited to have you back again after that phase 2 is completed, okay?
Yep.
Deal.
Absolutely.
Very good. You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Coming up, we'll tell you about next week's program. Stay with us. Are you looking for great gift ideas this holiday season? Take a look at the many books and DVDs available at mayoclinic.org. Book titles include the newest, Going Gluten-Free, and Mayo Clinic on Arthritis. Movie titles include Our Father Taught Us and Great Discoveries at Mayo Clinic. Go to mayoclinic.org, click Products and Services, and then click Books and More. Next week on Mayo Clinic Radio, Dr. Shives will be back. We're going to discuss liver transplant with Dr. Julie Heimbach and Dr. Charles Rosen. The Cliff Notes version of the program would probably sound like this. There have been some dramatic changes in the world of liver transplants, expanding the treatment option for patients who need transplants but haven't been suitable candidates. For instance, it wasn't that long ago that patients with hepatitis B or hepatitis C or a certain type of tumor wouldn't have been eligible for a liver transplant, but that's no longer necessarily the case. We'll also discuss a fairly novel approach to patients with obesity-related liver disease, which is to combine liver transplant with a bariatric surgery. And would you be surprised to know that obesity is also one of the fastest growing reasons for needing a liver transplant? The latest news on liver transplants next week on Mayo Clinic Radio. We hope you'll join us. For more information on topics discussed on this program, plus a video of Stacy Erholtz's story, visit our website, radio.mayoclinic.org. You can also access a podcast of today's program, as well as dozens and dozens of previously aired Mayo Clinic Radio episodes. Or you can visit us at mayoclinic.org, where over 3,000 physicians, scientists, and researchers from Mayo Clinic
share their expertise to empower you to better manage your health. You've been listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Our senior producer is Ron Petrovich. Our associate producer and phone screener is Audrey Castletine. Our technical director is Andy Brownell. Our theme music was written and performed by Chip Davis of Mannheim Steamroller. For Mayo Clinic Radio, Dr. Stephen Russell, Stacey Erholtz, and co-host Dr. Sanj Kakkar, I'm Tracy McCrae. Thanks for listening.
Any medical information conveyed during this program is not intended as a substitute for personal medical advice, and you should not take any action before consulting a healthcare professional. For more information, please go to our website, radio.mayoclinic.org. Please join us each week on this station for more of the medical information you want from Mayo Clinic specialists who know.